wonder, do you know people who it seems everything always falls in place for them? Nothing goes wrong. Whatever they want, they get. They're not even a Christian, but you are, and you're tempted to think, why have I got to deal with this? Why aren't things working for me? And as a Christian, do you sometimes feel that you're on the wrong side of history? The world has moved on. It's developed, and you're left out of step, believing the unbelievable. Well, if you've ever felt a bit like that, you're getting towards what Obadiah is driving at. Those are questions more on an individual level, but more than that, if you're a Christian, part of a church, there are questions that are relevant on a bigger scale, a more corporate question. Do you think the church is no longer the force for good that it once was? Being part of a church, especially a true one that really believes the Bible, is no longer as popular as it once was. With the rise of secularism, pluralism, all sorts of isms and identity politics. And you feel in the church that the surrounding culture and society is squeezing us ever more tighter. In a sense saying, conform to our ways or you'll be condemned and cast aside. Conform to our ways or you'll be condemned and cast aside. Well, Obadiah is the shortest book in the Old Testament. Obadiah, the author, we know very little about. There's another Obadiah in 1 Kings 18, but this would have been much earlier, and so not the same one. Obadiah, the name, means servant of the Lord, and what we know about this servant of the Lord comes from his short prophecy. So we're going to look at that, verses 1 to 9 tonight. And we see, if you look at verse 1, it is concerned with Edom. This is the nation descended from Esau. There's the nation of Israel from Jacob, and then there's Esau descendants known as the nation of Edom. At this point in Israel's history, it is concerned with the exile. This is written in the context of exile. That would have been in 586 BC. As verse 11 shows us what's going on here, it tells us that strangers were carrying off the people's wealth, that foreigners had entered Jerusalem's gates, and that lots were being cast. It's as if Jerusalem is a repossessed house being sold off on the cheap at auction. This seems a long way from its glory days in the Old Testament and God's promises. Promises to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and his 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel. They went to Egypt, they came out under Moses, they entered the promised land under Joshua. After him and the judges, they had their first king in Saul, followed by great David. And in 2 Samuel 7, we are told that he would have a son who would reign on his throne forever. David's initial son was Solomon, but after Solomon, the kingdom divided into two. There was the northern tribes known as Israel and the south known as Judah. There was faithlessness and disobedience under both nations' kings. And as a consequence then, in 722 BC, the northern kingdom was overrun by Assyria, the world's superpower at the time. The southern kingdom of Judah held on a little bit longer. There was the odd good king along the way. But then in 586, it too was invaded by the new superpower at the time, Babylon. They carried many of the people away into exile, and this is the context of the biblical story that Obadiah comes into. It seems like a pretty hopeless situation for God's people here compared to their former glories under Saul, David, Solomon. And particularly it would give rise to the question of how on earth was God going to keep those promises he made to Abraham and others when things now seem so bleak? Another issue Israel or Judah would have been wondering about was, what about that promise given to Rebekah in Genesis 25, verse 23? The one shall be stronger than the other, the older shall serve the younger. This was with Jacob and Esau at the stage of their birth. The older shall serve the younger. Judah would have been wondering here, is God not keeping his word? Will he keep his promises? Because as things stood, they were nearly wiped out, but Edom seemed to be flourishing. Well, the prophecy of Obadiah was one of God's answers to these questions. And it offers us answers and encouragement and reassurance today in the face of the cultural pressures the church is under and the decline of the church, especially in the West. Let me begin to explain God's answer in Obadiah by way of something familiar even to the youngest child. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. Well, there are a few different theories as to the origins and meaning of this famous nursery rhyme. One is that it is from Victorian times, and the puzzle was to work out who or what Humpty Dumpty was. In the early sketches, he's portrayed as an egg. Hence, after a fall, there'd be no surprise that a smashed egg couldn't be put together again. But earlier theories are that Humpty Dumpty was the name of a cannon on the walls of Colchester during the English Civil War, that it was knocked off by a parliamentary cannon shot and couldn't be put back together by the royalists, the king's men. Another view that it was Charles I himself that Humpty Dumpty refers to, or another view even earlier, is that it was Cardinal Wolsey, who had a quick downfall under Henry VIII. Another earlier view even than that is Richard III, but there's some of you probably are not that much into history, so we will move quickly on. But all of those who are listed, as well as the canon, they seem to be in a position of greatness, a position of strength, and yet they're brought low. And it makes sense in line with the nursery rhyme. It makes sense that it relates in some way to a king. Otherwise, why would the king's horses and men be on the scene trying to put Humpty together again? Also, sitting on a wall brings to mind a medieval castle with high walls. And after all, it was not just any old fall, but a great fall. The jury's still out on the exact identity of Humpty Dumpty. But as I say, each of these cases, it's a fall from grace. Position of greatness to being brought low. Now, you might be wondering why I'm unpacking the meaning of a nursery rhyme. That's not what we're here to do. We're here to unpack what God's Word has to say to us this evening. Well, the title of this sermon is Pride Comes Before a Fall. And that is perhaps an apt description of Humpty Dumpty. Was he feeling proud, sitting atop the wall, the tall wall, feeling untouchable before his great fall? Well, it's also a summary of what's going on in Obadiah, particularly in these first 9 verses we're considering this evening. We've already looked at verse 1 that sets the scene. There's going to be a rising up against Edom that comes from the Lord. It's as if Obadiah opens his book, his prophecy, in the middle of a courtroom scene. And this overall case warns us today to beware pride in your position, because God humbles the proud. Beware pride in your position, because God humbles the proud. Verses 2 to 9 show that Edom were a proud and powerful nation. Look at what it says about them. In verse 3, we're told we can interpret this off the back of what's coming to them, but we're shown that they dwelt in a secure, lofty dwelling, verse 3. They were wealthy with treasures, verse 6. They had made strategic, savvy political alliances in verse 7. All your allies, it talks about. They had wise men in verse 8. In verse 9, they had mighty men. This was a nation seemingly secure, as if nothing could touch them. Well, verses 2 to 9, as well as showing us the position that they were currently in when this book was written, it also presents us with the sentencing as part of a courtroom scene. And there are 3 sentences handed out, and they're all connected to Edom's pride of heart that you can read there in verse 3. It says, "The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock." Verses 2 to 9 pick apart Edom's pride and its position and show how God is going to turn around or against them all their apparent strengths. So there's 3 sentences from the judge, and let's look at those. The first one is in verses 2 to 4. Verses 2 to 4, pride leads to being despised. Mentioned they lived in a lofty dwelling. They saw themselves as secure in their position. They lived in the clefts of the rock. They had incorporated the natural environment. They had built upon this natural environment that suited their purposes. And so they seemed secure. It was as if they were in this fortress, like a cannon on top of a city wall. Who was going to attack them? Who was going to bring them down to the ground? They ask at the end of verse 3. But we're told in this sentence that they're going to be made small in verse 2. And in verse 4, we're told that the Lord, he says, I will bring you down. So they are going to be despised. They gloried in the fact that they were great, but soon they were going to be despised. They were going to be considered small rather than big. And the reason for this, the pride of their heart has deceived them, which is an irony in many ways, because if you think back to who Edom is descended from Esau and Jacob, and the name Jacob means the deceiver. We read of the stories in Genesis of how Jacob deceived Esau, how Esau ended up without his birthright, without his blessing. Jacob was the deceiver there, but here it's not that Jacob, not that the sons of Israel are deceiving Edom. No, Edom is self-deceived. The pride of their heart has deceived them. So pride leads to them being despised. It's a reversal of their greatness. They will be made small. Even look at what it says about the eagle. They saw themselves as this great eagle, this great bird of prey in the sky, as if their nest was up in the stars. They saw themselves as the real rulers. They were up against God, the King of all creation, the one who created the eagle, the one who placed the stars in the sky. And so God was going to bring them to a place of being despised. The second sentence we have in this court case comes in verses 5 to 7. And it's all to do with their possessions. The sentence is, pride leads to being made desolate. Pride leads to being made desolate. It says, if thieves came to you, if plunderers came by night, how you have been destroyed. Would they not steal only enough for themselves? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? The author's making a comparison with other common thieves, or those who came to steal the grapes. They would still leave the gleanings. They wouldn't take every last grape from the fields. That's what verses 5 and 6 line up for us. Verse 5 lines up for us. But then verse 6 brings this great contrast about what's going to happen to Edom. It says how Esau has been pillaged. His treasures have been sought out. They're not just going to suffer a burglary where they come in and think they have got little time and just steal what they can see there and then. No, no. Esau's biggest treasures, the treasures that they've hidden deep away, even those are going to be sought out, and they're going to be left bereft of any possessions they thought they had. And their allies are no longer going to be supporting them as well, another trust that they had. They thought they had made these great political allegiances, and yet they're deceived by them too. And the third sentence then comes in verses 8 and 9. Pride leads to being dismayed. Verses 8 and 9 talk about, again, these wise men that they had, these men of understanding and these mighty men. It was as if this was a nation that had it all. They had protection, they had security in where they lived, they had possessions and wealth and treasures, and here we see they had wise men, astute politicians, men of understanding, mighty men who could fight off any attempt at bringing them down. And yet we're told here that God is going to lead them to dismay. God is going to cut off and destroy these wise men. And so what happens with all of these sentences, we basically have a total punishment on Edom. This is not some trivial punishment which doesn't frustrate the guilty too much. I'm sure you know what I mean. You hear occasionally about some wealthy millionaire being found guilty of something, and the sentence involves some meagre fine of a few hundred pounds. They like me being fined 1p. Wouldn't bother me a penny. I could hand it over. And we get in a rage about this because we think that's not true justice. No, the sentencing here for Obadiah is true justice. All the things they thought they were trusting in are worth nothing. This punishment is a reversal of their fortunes. It is a fall from grace. Think of a well-known example of this. Think of Marie Antoinette, once the darling of France, marrying King Louis. She was maybe celebrated in the way that Princess Diana captured the public imagination here, but then it all came crumbling down so quickly for Marie Antoinette. She's the one that the rumor goes, not sure whether it's true. She was told about the lack of food, the food shortages in France. She was told the people have no bread, and she said, "We'll let them eat cake or let them eat brioche." Very quickly, she went from being the darling in France to being beheaded at the guillotine. This was a complete downfall, and that's what's going to happen in the book of Obadiah for the Edomites. Now, if we think about what this means, both for the Edomites as well as for God's people reading this, we can move towards how is this relevant for us here this evening. Well, first, if we think about the Edomites, all this would lead to despair for an Edomite who believed it was going to happen. They'd be led to a point of despair. On the flip side, for an Israelite, for one of God's people, for someone from the tribe of Judah who believed it would happen, who had been led off into exile, they would believe and they would have a point of hope, not just for destruction, but for the fulfilling of God's promises, that God was still going to keep these promises that seemed so difficult to keep in the midst of what they were going through. So there's a message for the Edomites, there's a message for the Israelites. The message for us is that God punishes pride, and we need to beware of having God as our enemy, because the destruction, the judgment will be total. And this is a hard part of Scripture to deal with, a hard message to hear. But as we come to think about this, there are two angles we have then on application in light of the Edomites and in light of God's people. And the first is, if we think of this picture of pride, we can see it in both an individual way and also in a corporate way. Because remember, Edom is referred to in verse 6 there as Esau. Edom is a nation, so it's corporate, it's collective, and yet it's descended from this one man, Esau. And if we think about applying this idea of pride individually, but also then corporately, we can get a sense of what this teaches us. I wonder, do you see yourself as a person who is proud? Maybe not. What is pride? Well, pride is saying, look at me, look at what I've got, look at what I've achieved, look how much I've got in my bank account. It's feeling secure in your own achievements, your own accomplishments. We live here in Bangor, the haves and the have-yots. Maybe you live in a way that is proud. It's not just for the non-Christian, but even for Christians, we're tempted to trust not in Christ, but to think that we're secure because of how healthy our bank account is, how good our job is, what status our job has over the status of others. This comes from pride. Pride like the Edomites who felt they were so great. And maybe you're here and you're not one of the have-yots. Maybe you're one of the have-nots and you're thinking, well, I haven't achieved that much. But really, pride is one side of a coin. And the other side of the same coin is self-pity. Maybe you're someone sitting here tonight, and it's not so much pride as you seeing yourself as such a strong person. Maybe you're not someone who looks in the mirror and thinks, I'm great. Maybe you're someone who thinks, look at me, what I haven't achieved. Look at me, I'm a victim. Look at me, how hard I find things. But the reason pride and self-pity are two sides of the same coin is because the coin is engraved with, look at me. That's what it's about. Look at me, whether as a victim or whether as someone who thinks they're great. And in the eyes of God, you need to humble yourself before Him, to not trust in yourself, to not look to yourself or to want others to look to yourself, but you need to look to Him. You need to humble yourself and look to Him, as Hannah in 1 Samuel did, as Mary did. You need to look to Him. You need to be convinced of the judgment that is to come for those who refuse to bow the knee, and you need to be ready and aware that God will bring judgment to those who are proud. So there's the individual pride, the boasting in what oneself has achieved, but there's also the corporate, and that's in many ways, there's been lots of nations who have seen themselves as invincible throughout the centuries. Mentioned earlier, the context here, the Assyrians were once the superpower of the time. The Assyrians rose and they fell. The Babylonians came along, they rose and they fell. The Greeks under Alexander the Great rose and fell. The Roman Empire rose and fell. The Nazis rose and they fell. There's rising and falling across the nations throughout time, and that still goes on. We hear about nations like North Korea seeking to plot nuclear warfare. So we still see that going on. And yet there's another corporate pride that goes on. And it's a cultural thing rather than maybe a national thing, that particularly in the West, there's this pride in what we have achieved as humanity. Pride in development. Looking back at the past, looking at any sort of tradition, any sort of history, any sort of norms that have been in place for hundreds or even thousands of years, and thinking, we know better. We know what's what now. We can change laws in light of our new understanding of things. There's great pride in this culturally. And that can be hard to come up against if you're part of God's people. Of course, that's thinking very much for where we are, but there, of course, is also the pride of nations across the world who continue to persecute God's people in very physical ways. So pride, like the Edomites. One of the questions that Obadiah asks us tonight is, are you a bit like the Edomites, standing proud against God? Are you going to be humbled before Him in light of this message that judgment is coming? There's individual pride, whether self-pity or pride, two sides of the same coin. There's cultural pride, and yet we need to remember that nations rise and nations fall under God. And the current cultural pride that is there one day too will fall, because we are heading towards Christ's kingdom. The second line of application then is to do with God's people. God's people who are terribly weak, but will rise in glory. Israel here, cast off in exile, asking those questions of, will God answer His promises? Will He fulfill His promises? There seems to be a no apparent deliverance from this exile in sight, and yet God has made these promises of a new land, a new status, and an eternal kingdom with a son of David on the throne forever. And so we come to that son of David who will sit on the throne forever, and that's Jesus. Jesus comes to Israel as a true Israelite, and He experiences, even from His firstborn, Herod. Herod the Great. Herod was an Idumean, the Greek, or the Latin word for an Edomite, and he was descended then from the Edomites. And what did Herod do? Herod the Great, When Jesus was born, he sought to end the life of Jesus as a baby. He killed all of the baby boys in Bethlehem and that area. Here was Jesus under threat from this proud king, this proud Edomite. And yet he went on and he survived that. And then he came to his trial, and one of Herod's descendants, another Edomite, with an alliance with a superpower of the day, just as the Edomites were allied with Babylon in Obadiah. Herod, Pontius Pilate, casting their judgment on Jesus, a true Israelite, faced with persecution, with betrayal, and with death. And yet, though it seemed so hopeless, though it seemed so hard, how is God going to fulfill his promises? It was in just that death, followed by resurrection and a rise to glory, that true Israel experienced just a picture of what was to come. And so we have in Jesus, as we look at what happens to God's people in Obadiah, as we look forward to what happens with Jesus, we see that God delivered his son from the hands of Herod. We see that Jesus is the great king who rescued his people. And if you think back to what I began with early on there about Humpty Dumpty, the king's men and the king's horses couldn't put them together again. Because this was someone who was proud. Whether it was Charles I, whether it was Richard III, this was someone who sat on the wall thinking they were great and had this great fall. They couldn't be put together because they saw themselves as a proud imposter king. And yet, those who are proud, those who are led to a point of despair, can be put together again by the true king, not the proud imposter. They can be put together by Jesus. So if you're sitting here tonight and you have not been trusting in God, maybe you made a profession of faith years ago, but recently, over the years, you're just proud. Proud of who you are, what you look like, what you've achieved, what you've accomplished. This part of God's word cuts us down in our pride, but it also points us to Jesus, the one who was cut down, so that then we might be raised up in him. And there's a word of encouragement here as well for God's suffering church. In the midst of persecution across the world, although the church appears weak and enemies appear strong, or places like Northern Ireland, like the Western world, where the church is wanting to be, or people want to condemn it, cast it aside, call it names, ridicule it, well, there is application. The application that though God's enemies seem strong, there is hope that God is going to fulfill his purposes. He will fulfill his promises, just as he would do for Obadiah and what he wrote, but also as we look forward to the new heavens and the new earth. And so Obadiah is about Edom, it's about Israel, but it's also about us, and it's about the church, and it's about God's threats to God's purposes, and about recognizing that God is in control of his promises and that he will bring these to completion. And so as we come to a close here tonight, we're going to stand and sing a hymn which very much brings out this call for us to humble ourselves before God. When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss, and pour contempt on all my pride. Nothing else will do. We cannot cling to anything in ourselves. Forbid me, Lord, that I should boast, save in the death of Christ my God. All the vain things that charm me most, I sacrifice them to his blood. Let's stand and sing.